I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Happy holiday, everybody. Today on this day of service that commemorates the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., my guests are three activists who are making a difference in Baltimore and beyond. The author DeRay McKesson hosts the popular podcast Pod Save the People, and he's a co-founder of Campaign Zero, an effort to end police violence. Asma Inj Hanif is a chaplain and nurse practitioner who runs the Muslimat Al-Nisa shelter and provides health care to underserved communities in Baltimore. The Reverend Alvin Hathaway is the driving force behind the Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center, which will house initiatives for children and scholars as well as job training programs. They join me today on Midday after the news.
Has not begun to live until he can rise above the narrow confines of his own individual concerns to the broader concerns of all humanity.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking at the New Covenant Baptist Church in Chicago, Illinois on the 9th of April, 1967. He would be murdered in Memphis less than a year later. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. On this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday and day of service, here on our program, we're going to meet three people for whom every day is a day of service. A little later, I'll speak with a nurse practitioner and chaplain, Asma Inj Hanif, who provides medical services and shelter for victims of domestic violence. And we'll speak with the Reverend Alvin Hathaway, who is spearheading efforts to build the Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center on Baltimore's West Side. But we begin today with DeRay McKesson, a Baltimore native who has risen to national prominence as an activist on behalf of social justice. He's the host of Pod Save the People, the author of the book called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope, and one of the leaders and co-founders of Campaign Zero, whose mission is to eliminate police violence. DeRay McKesson joins us on Zoom from New York. Happy holiday, DeRay. It's good to have you back.
Hey, it's been a while. How are you doing?
It has been a minute, and I'm glad that we could connect again. I'm doing fine. I hope you are, too. Let's talk about Campaign Zero and the progress, if you think you've made any, when it comes to police violence. There were 860 shootings of killings by police in 2021. It's roughly the same as it's been in the last few years. Where do you think it stands when it comes to police and the people they're pursuing?
Yeah, I think when you say the 800 number, you must be getting that from the Washington Post. We count a little bit over 1,100 people. So 1,136 is our number. And just as a quick distinction, the Washington Post only includes people who got killed by a gun. So George Floyd's not in their database, whereas we count everybody who died by an officer on duty, off duty, all weapons. So a little bit over 1,100. The police have killed pretty consistently for as long as we've had data. And I think that there are some bright spots, but overall, the numbers are still pretty bad. You know, we helped on the Maryland bill. So Maryland was the first state to have a law enforcement officer bill of rights in 1975, also the first state a year ago to repeal it. And there were 19 states that restricted use of force in the past year, and we worked on those. Every single state that restricted the execution of no-knock raids, we did those bills, those laws across the country. So there is some good stuff happening at the structural level. And I think about on this day, in honor of Dr. King, is that one of the things that he taught us was to make sure that we not only change the narrative, but also change systems and structures. And the last thing I'll say is that one of the proudest projects that we worked on is the case about Keith Davis.
And Keith Davis is a local case here. We can talk about that in a second. But when it comes to the overall rate of shootings by police officers, obviously some of those people were armed, some were unarmed. I mean, since 2015 and you're right, I did get the number of 860 from the Washington Post, who've kept a database since 2015. Some 4,000 plus people who had been shot by police or killed by police had been holding guns themselves. 429 were unarmed. The incidences of unarmed people of color being assaulted and in cases like George Floyd, killed by police, you know, certainly get a lot of attention. They get a lot of play in the media because there are often videos accompanying what's going on. But there are, of course, many, I'm sure, that don't have any video evidence. Has there been, given the Black Lives Matter protests since the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, et cetera, has there been, in your mind, a substantive change to the narrative? Are more people beginning to understand the sort of length and breadth of this problem, or is education about that still a main focus of your work?
Yeah, I think that people do understand the problem a little bit better than they did in 2014 and 15, for sure. I'm not trying to nitpick, but I'll just push a little bit on the numbers. Is that, remember, the challenge with the Washington Post is that they code you as armed if you had anything in your hand at the time of death. So the number you're referencing are people who had buckets, Nintendo controllers, screwdrivers in their hand. It is not actually the way I think you meant it, which is like armed with a deadly weapon. The Washington Post counts anything in your hand as a deadly weapon, essentially, in their methodology, which is why we don't use that numbers. And I love the Washington Post, hate the database that they use.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I looked at it, there is a breakdown of guns, knives, other implements. I mean, they do have a breakdown since 2015. They don't have a breakdown per year that I noticed. But as you say, people are starting to at least pay attention because of the Washington Post and your efforts. You have a thing called Nix the Six, which is concerning police unions. You mentioned some of the laws in Maryland that you worked on, but talk about the role of police unions and what's going on nationally to revise the contracts with unions, and whether you think that that's also a substantive step forward.
Yeah, so, you know, we have the only database of police union contracts in the country there at nix6.org, and we also have the only analysis of the 22 states that are remaining that have state-level protections for the police. And this is huge. It's like you will never be able to change a police department's budget or discipline officers or move to a conception of safety that doesn't center police or people with guns responding to things is the only way to deal with safety if you don't go through the contracts or these laws. So you think about in Baltimore, there's a provision of the contract that makes it very, very hard to have an officer get a drug test after they kill somebody. You're like, why is that even something that we negotiate? That sort of feels weird. In places like California, the law says that any investigation of an officer that lasts more than a year can never result in discipline, regardless of the outcome. In Detroit, the contract literally says that if an officer is convicted of domestic abuse, then they have to stay on the department payroll for 9 months to give them sufficient runway to fight those charges. And they can stay on for another 3 months after that if they are not acquitted or the charges are dropped by them. You know, so it's a set of protections that nobody else gets. It's why we don't say anymore that the police are above the law. We remind people that the police actually have their own laws.
DeRay McKesson is the host of Pod Save the People and a co-founder of Campaign Zero. It's the Martin Luther King holiday edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, DeRay, is there a distinction between the work that you're doing, trying to change police contracts, as you've just mentioned, and trying to have police departments initiate and implement policies that you very succinctly and thoroughly lay out on the Campaign Zero website? Do you distinguish that work from the work of those who operate under the rubric of defund the police, people who would like to abolish police departments? I spoke with Derricka Purnell a few months ago about her book called Becoming Abolitionist. There are people and a movement who just see no role for police whatsoever. Is there a distinction between the work you're doing and the defund the police movement? How would you discern between the two?
Here's what I'll say is that, I'm a practitioner. I'm somebody who does this work every single day. I'm not a theorist. I'm not somebody who simply writes about this work, but this is the work I do every day. And I say that because there's nobody I know who actually does the work day in and day out that is not wrestling between two things, that is not in the tension between these two things. One is, how do we alleviate the pain and suffering that people are feeling in their lives every single day? And how do we undo the overall system? So it's the tension between the end of solitary confinement and the end of incarceration. I believe that we should not put people in a cell for 23 hours and let them out for one. And I believe that we shouldn't put people in cages at all. But I'm actually not having, it's a false choice to say that I can only do one of those things. In the same way that mutual aid or helping people in neighborhoods with food banks, all those, I know a food bank is not the end of poverty. I get it. That doesn't make the work around food banks a bad thing. So what I would push and say is that this idea that I have to choose between one of the two is actually something to strip people of their humanity, both people in community, organizers, and people who stand in any realm of trying to help. So when I think about this, I think just like any actual organizer, I know that we are always doing both. So in Maryland, you know, we did repeal the Officer Bill of Rights. We restricted no-knock raids, and we are all working to try and figure out a world where we know the police only respond, only 5% of their 911 calls are violent crime in the first place. So we know that we can live in a world beyond policing, and those two things are not at odds. But again, I'd say there is no actual organizer I know in any community who is not at once facing the tension between both of those two realms.
And as a pragmatic political matter, there are those who've said that because the Democratic Party, voices on the left who are pushing for, you know, major changes to the way police are conceived and funded and the way they operate, that is, as a political matter, a difficult strategy because it's driving people away from the cause and into the arms of the Republican Party, which premise their approach to law enforcement as a punitive one, you know, the mentality that says stiffer sentences and mandatory minimums are the answer. Do you think, as a practical matter, that the concentration on police and what they've done, and the concentration on how police departments are funded, is moving the general cause ahead?
Yeah. So I here's what I'll say is that what is true is that I'm never fighting people over a slogan. I don't care. I'm fighting people over the idea. And the idea is that we spend a whole lot of money on something that is called a solution that is not proven to have a whole lot of results. So you think about the Baltimore City Police Department. They have not had a solve rate above 50% for homicides in a pretty long time. You know, they are not solving much of the crime and certainly not stopping much of it. So the question becomes, like, where can we put that money otherwise? Whether you call it, you know, a phrase that drives some people nuts, or you talk about it another way, the idea makes sense to me. Now, what I will say about the phrase in question is that a part of the work of organizing is to not to be so arrogant to believe that the only way to enter is the way I enter. And what's true is that defund is not a good entrance for some people. And that's fair. So my work as an organizer is to figure out another way to get you to the idea. For some people, that is a really good way. But I'm never like sticking my heels in the ground about a phrase, thinking that, like, if you don't believe in that phrase or like the phrase, then you don't believe in Black people or don't believe in the idea. There are people I know, like I think about my aunt, I think about so many other people in the city, in our city, who that phrase is not a good phrase for them either. And that's okay, right? So part of my work is to figure out another way to get you to the idea and not to be so arrogant to believe that the only way to get to the idea is my way.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, on the Campaign Zero platform, there are a number of policies that you're recommending that all police departments across the country adapt that I think an awful lot of people would agree with: limiting the use of force, ending what's called broken windows policing, body cameras, filming, you know, that kind of thing. These are things that I think a lot of people are very happy that many departments, including Baltimore, have adopted. I do want to talk about the case of Keith Davis Jr. He's been incarcerated for 6 years now, 7 years almost. He's been tried four different times and has not had a sustained conviction. He's been accused of a murder. Why take up this particular case, and is Campaign Zero planning to, you know, place a spotlight on other cases around the country as well?
Yeah, so, you know, when I got people together to start Campaign Zero in 2015, I never thought that we'd do individual cases. Like, we sort of do systemic, structural policy things at scale. And I knew Kelly, and I knew the activists in the city. I'd heard about the case, but I just didn't know a lot about it. So I listened to the podcast, and then I actually personally read every single transcript from all five trials. And we made a site, KeithDavisJr.org. You can go see it. And I personally mapped out every inconsistency through all five trials. And when I got to the end, I was like, I can't believe I didn't know. It is such a clear case of police misconduct. And it's such an interesting case and a reminder that the police actually cannot act alone. That this was not just rogue police officers firing 40 shots into a garage with a guy who, at best, even at the police own admission, did not actually shoot at them. The gunshot examiner said that the gun was actually never fired that Keith is supposed to have had. And remember, he was acquitted for that whole incident that supposedly led to him being in that space at that time. So, like, I read it, and you look at it, and you're like, it wasn't just the police. It was Mosby's office. It was Mosby digging her heels in about this. It was like a whole apparatus that just allowed these lies to fester. It's why I've been pretty vocal that she should resign. And, you know, when I think about the indictment against Mosby most recently, it is not surprising to me, because she has told things that have not turned out to be true a number of times, not only with the case, but just in general about her work in that office. And I don't know how you know, when I think about the state's attorney's office, it's like, we expect you to stop crime, not perpetrate crime. And if we can't expect you to just at least tell the truth, I mean, that is the lowest bar that there is. And she has not met that.
And I can recommend to readers a article in Baltimore Magazine last month, the December issue of Baltimore Magazine by Ron Cassie, about the trial. And as you say, Dre, there's a podcast, and there's been a number of people who've written about it for people who want to get up to speed. That's all the time we have, Dre. Dre McKesson is the host of Pod Save the People and a founder of Campaign Zero. Thanks so much. Happy holiday, and look forward to our next time we can connect.
Talk to you later.
And coming up, we will meet Chaplain Asma Inj Hanif, a nurse practitioner who provides health care in underserved communities. She joins me after a quick break. But before we take that break, I do want to take a moment to remember Dante Barksdale, an outreach coordinator for Safe Streets, who was shot to death on the Sunday of Martin Luther King weekend 1 year ago. As I said, just after he was murdered as a violence interrupter, Dante dedicated the last 10 years of his life to de-escalating disputes and intervening in situations where he convinced people who were considering violence to consider an alternative. He repeatedly placed himself in dangerous situations, using his skill, intelligence, and compassion to show people a better way, a safer way, a way forward. He was trying to make Baltimore better. He refused to give up on young people who had, in some instances, given up on themselves. Dante knew the pressures and stresses that people in communities of color experience and how those challenges can sometimes lead to bad decision-making. He knew about this because of his own life experience and because of his empathy and his love. And several months after Dante was killed, another Safe Streets worker, Kenyell Wilson, was shot to death in his Cherry Hill neighborhood. Dante Barksdale was 46 years old. Kenyell Wilson was 44. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our show, my guest will be Dr. Thomas Scalia of the R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center at the University of Maryland. We'll talk to him about his experiences there as a surgeon and as a pioneer in the field of traumatic injury care. That's tomorrow on Midday. And this news, about the passing of another notable figure. Last night, Vice President Kamala Harris and Secretary of Defense Lloyd J. Austin III announced the death of one of the last remaining Tuskegee Airmen. Brigadier General Charles McGee flew 409 fighter combat missions in World War II, the Korean War, and in Vietnam. He has died at the age of 102. If you've just joined us today on the Martin Luther King holiday and day of service, we are meeting with people who are working to advance and empower people in their communities. My next guest is Chaplain Asma Inj Hanif. She is a nurse practitioner and activist who's worked in underserved communities for more than 30 years. Asma Inj Hanif joins us on Zoom. Madam Chaplain, welcome. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us about, first, the Healthy Solutions Clinic that you founded some years ago. What kind of work do you do there?
Okay. A lot of my information relates to my history of growing up as an impoverished person in North Carolina. And my grandmother, and I always have to give credit to those ancestors who came before me. My grandmother actually worked for a physician in North Carolina, and I actually said that she worked as what I called a maid slave. And she went to him, and she told him that she had felt a little knot in her stomach, which was about the size of like a green pea. And he told her, don't worry about it. He said, it will never amount to anything. 5 years later, that turned into the cancer that killed her. And it was at that point that I realized, and I was in the ninth grade, that I said that, you know what, I wanted to be able to go to school and be a nurse to do something to help individuals like my grandmother. People who maybe had no status, you know, no merit, you know, they didn't matter to anyone in society. Because, you know, you could go to school and you could help those who already have all the other amenities, but I wanted to help people like my grandmother. And that was the beginning of Alnisa Healthy Solutions, because wanting to do just that.
And you are a nurse practitioner as well as a chaplain. So the Alnisa Healthy Solutions Clinic, what services does it offer? Where does it operate? What is the community that you're serving?
Okay, it's actually in Baltimore, Maryland. I've been doing the work for actually 45 years. And something that I've always like to share is that wherever I've lived, I've always had the health center, because remember, the goal stemmed from being my grandmother. And I've been in Baltimore for over 25 years, you know, doing the work. And what I did was I provided services, just basic health services. And being a female, you know, health practitioner, I also specialize, you know, in women's health. But anyone who needed any type of a service, they could come there, whether they had insurance or not, it didn't matter. Because it was, like, again, in honor of my grandmother. And I'm still doing that in a reduced method now, only because of COVID, but I still have the health center. I have never stopped, you know, doing that. And so that's why I say the individuals that I serve are those who are normally the ones that are marginalized, that no one else cared anything about.
And of course, I'm sure COVID has made your work extremely difficult, because I would imagine that many of the health challenges that your patients present to you have to do with COVID. How has it been these last couple of years?
It's been difficult, and a lot of it had to do with when I was reaching out to the powers that be, who had the ability to facilitate the work that I was doing. They did not offer me any help. So because the clinic is set up in such a way that I would take care of people whether they could pay or not, the majority of the finances came from those few who might would come who could pay. But then, and so during that time, it was based on whatever my resources were. But when COVID came, the thing that I wanted was to be the ability to be able to have the testing kits, because I could not just go out and purchase those. So I requested from the mayor, from the governor, from Baltimore City Council, from anybody that had it. I wrote grants trying to be able to get the testing kits so that I could be able to help those people who were not being served anywhere else. The clinic is actually in what they considered a hot spot, and it still is. There was no health service, you know, anywhere around. And even though they offered testing, you either had to have a vehicle to drive to the places, you know, or you had to have insurance or the ability to even just get there, or a doctor's referral. And the people that I served didn't have any of those. So the only thing that I could do was I would contact all of the people that I had helped over the years. I would ask them, how are they doing? Did you need anything? And if they told me that they exhibited any of the symptoms of COVID or had been exposed, then I would send them a prescription. I would write an order for them to be able to go to one of those agencies who had the test to be able to get it done. And in fact, the joy in that was there were several people who when they would call me back and they would let me know that they were positive. There was one woman who her whole family was positive, and she had actually sent her children to go and stay with her her brother-in-law. And come to find out that he was positive as well. And I wrote a prescription for him, even though he wasn't one of my clients, you know, one of my patients, that I wrote a prescription for him. He went to Johns Hopkins and they admitted him because he was, if he had not gone on that day, he basically would have died. And I share that story because they were, you know, it did my heart good to know that I had made a difference in someone's life. And even before when I first found out about needing the test, I was the first person that I know of to request from all of these agencies to allow me to have the test, to allow me to be able to send them to me so that I could go around and travel to the neighborhood where people were not being served. And they never responded. They never gave me anything, even to this day. I request for the tests. I request for the vaccines. I was requesting for the PPE. I was requesting all of those things in order to be able to continue to do the work that I was doing. And I guess my voice, even though I've been doing this work all these years, it wasn't political enough or strong enough.
And what's really disconcerting is that it's not that you're unknown to some of the people who have the authority to make those resources available. I mean, President Obama honored you. Governor Hogan honored you. You were a Ravens hometown hero. It's not as if you've been hiding, you know, hiding this work. It would seem to me that this is a perfect fit for community-based operation. Have you heard anything in the last, you know, week or two? Because we have Mayor Scott saying that there are more tests on the way. We have the governor saying there's more. We have the president saying there's more tests on the way. We have the governor saying he's going to distribute many hundreds of thousands of KN95 masks. Have you heard anything in recent days that leads you to believe that you will be in fact given access to resources that you're going to need?
No, I haven't. And on every occasion when I have emailed them, well, calling is just it didn't happen, but I would email them, I would mail them, you know, all of these requests, and what I get is that. What's that standardized response? Oh, you know what? We are here and we're, you know, going to help, you know, we're going to respond back as soon as we can. I actually started this request before the Brandon Scott was the mayor, but before then. That's how long ago I have been trying to be able to get these, what I needed. And I even, you know, use up all of our PPE from, like I said, whenever money that I was able to come up with. To the point that it was all gone. I would see people on the street in my neighborhood who didn't have a mask when the government, you know, when the governor mandated that you had to have a mask, or I guess you'd be arrested or whatever they were going to do. And I distributed them on the street in front of our office. And I couldn't, and even when I would go around and I would see people who might have been standing on the street needing, you know, because they were needing, you know, like asking for money or for help. And I would, if I drove around and I would give them, you know, the mask, I depleted everything that we had, unfortunately, to the point that I ended up getting COVID and almost died myself. I was somebody on the front line. I've had a GoFundMe out there for a couple of years all trying to be able to get these supplies. We purchased, along with myself and Ayub Hanif, is like my son and the CEO of Healthy Solutions, we purchased vehicles to be able to drive around and be mobile clinics to go into these neighborhoods. And without the equipment, all we ended up doing, the supplies that we needed, all we ended up doing was having some vans, you know, that was on our yard. And instead of them helping, the city fined me for having vehicles parked on grass. Oh, and was trying to put a lien on our property. I mean, the things that they were doing, it breaks my heart.
And Chaplain Hanif, yeah, it does. It breaks our hearts to hear it as well. How are you feeling now?
Well, I actually have what they call long COVID because I didn't know that I kept going. And I'm only recently, well, when I say recently, in maybe the past 3 months, been back out, you know, trying to be on the computer, trying to be, because it messed with my eyes. COVID is no joke. I'm telling anybody out there. And I have started now trying to get, you know, to reach out and doing the same thing, making the same requests that are not being honored. And I can hear on the news where they're saying they have all these tests. And yes, I sent it to the president. I sent anybody that I thought would listen. But something that I did want to say to you is when you talk about all the awards, but remember the awards, I'm being nominated by the people I help. They're the ones who are always, you know, nominating me for something. So I have mantles, of awards and certificates and all of these other good things, but it doesn't translate into the people who, even those agencies that are granted, it doesn't translate into getting any of the supplies that I needed.
Yeah, and so we have a few minutes left, and I do want to also talk to you about the fact that you're the director and founder of the only Muslim women's shelter in the entire United States. Tell us about that work.
Well, I started that work, and I have to preference this when I was asking that question. I started that work was because Muslim women were victims of domestic violence, and I actually speak on that, and it's also why I went to school to be a chaplain. The problem is, and I never wanted to be focused on that. It's the one just for Muslims. I only started it because when Muslim women were going to other facilities as victims of domestic violence, they were told that they had to come up out of that religion, being Muslim, in order to be able to get the services that they required. That hurt my feelings. And that's the reason why now I speak on the matter. And I let people know that domestic violence is criminal. It's not religious. So you should not, penalize a person who's a victim of domestic violence simply because of their faith tradition. And that's the reason why I started. I said, if I had money, I'd have a triplex and have everybody, be in their own faith tradition to be able to be there. But something that I discovered is that when a person is going through domestic violence, the only thing that lets them survive is their handhold to God. You want to strengthen that handhold, not break it.
And of course, you offer halal food and regular prayers during the day and other things that adhere to the Muslim tradition. You used to have two locations. You've had to close one of them, but you still do have one of them. And we don't talk about the location of this place, but you are still running one of the shelters and serving some of the Muslim women who've encountered this horrible issue of domestic violence here in town.
Yes, I'm still providing all of the services, just on whether in the clinic, and even like I said, speaking now, or even in the shelter throughout the pandemic. I just had to, to reduce the numbers of individuals that I can help. And I'm being also contacted to be able to accept, the refugees that came, to this area or even to this country, because they know that I've been doing this work for all these years. Yeah. The sadness is that I don't have the financial means or support to be able to respond to all of those who contacted me and asked me for help. And it breaks my heart.
All right. Well, then if there are listeners who want to help you out in that regard, we'll have a link to information on our website so that they can do that. Chaplain Asma Inge Hanif, thank you so much for your work day in and day out and for your time today on the show. I appreciate it.
I need to say one thing. Please give me 30 seconds because you talked about the Tuskegee Airmen. My father is John T. Inge, right? He was one of the original Mumford Point Marines. And they were the ones that integrated the Marines. And so he was also awarded the Congressional Medal by Obama. They were finally given it. And he was one of the last survivors of that. And I honor him on this, you know, Black history, you know, in Black history and in terms of, you know, this beloved day. I never say or do anything without at least, you know, giving him, you know, that honor.
All right. Well, we honor him along with you. Thank you so much, Chaplain Asma Inge Hanif. Coming up, Reverend Alvin Hathaway. He recently retired from the pulpit of the historic Union Baptist Church. Now he's working to restore an historic building in his West Baltimore community. Reverend Hathaway joins me on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. On this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday and day of service, we are meeting a few folks who make every day a day of service. My next guest is Reverend Alvin Hathaway, who retired a few months ago as the pastor of the historic Union Baptist Church in West Baltimore. Now he's heading the effort to transform a historic school building on the west side into an amenity center. Reverend Hathaway joins us on Zoom. Reverend, welcome back. It's always great to talk to you.
Brother Tom, it's good to talk to you as well, and it's a tremendous holiday, and it is a holiday where we focus on service.
Yes, and happy holiday to you as well, and tell us about this historic school. It's on Division Street. It's called PS 103, the Henry Highland Garnett School. This is an historic building, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It was a building that was designed in 1877 by George Frederick. People may not know that name, but George Frederick designed our own Baltimore City Hall, designed our Baltimore City College High School, designed the Howard P. Rawlins Conservatory in Drew Hill Park, designed the state office building, as well as Lawyers Mall. And then in 1877, he designed this school there in West Baltimore in the Upton section at 1315 Division Street. It was a school that was attended beginning in around 1905-06 by African Americans as they migrated to West Baltimore. And then in 1914, here comes young Thurgood Marshall, who is at that school from 1914 until 1921.
And you want to establish the Justice Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center in this building. What are your plans? You have a number of partnerships that you're going to implement to do a variety of things. Tell us about some of the programs that you'll be offering.
Yes, we will. Just think about it. Justice Thurgood Marshall, as we honor the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King is really synonymous with Atlanta, Georgia. I would say that Justice Thurgood Marshall should be to Baltimore, Maryland, as the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King is to Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah. We should celebrate the amazing accomplishments of him. He was the architect of the civil rights movement. When you think about his law cases, Murray versus Pearson, where African-Americans now who had been denied attending the University of Maryland School of Law now can attend there. When you think about Shelley Drift versus Kramer, where you had basically restrictive covenants that people couldn't live in certain neighborhoods, he had that struck down. And of course, Brown versus Board of Education, just an amazing architect of our civil rights history. And so I think that his school, which is of national significance, should become a place where people throughout our city and specifically in that community can go there and have experiences that inspire them and inform them. And so we have in this amenity center, we're going to have the Judge Alexander Wynn Center for Education, Justice, and Ethics. So we're going to continue that whole vein of understanding civics and legal rights. We'll train young lawyers. We'll expose persons to the field of jurisprudence. We begin to teach civics to our young people in the community. We're going to have another program that I think is going to be absolutely phenomenal, and that is called Project Takeoff. And that project is with the Maryland Aviation Administration. That's the administration that manages the BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport and Martin Marietta Airport. We're going to have a program there that exposes adults and children to the whole field of airport management and aviation. We'll have flight simulators. We'll have virtual reality, and basically to teach people the skills of this growing enterprise, which is our airport, just a stone's throw from Baltimore City. And then we're going to have programs where we begin to teach history. We'll have history about Justice Thurgood Marshall. We'll have we're going to recreate the office of Elijah Cummings, Congressman Elijah Cummings. We will bequeath all of his campaign memorabilia. We're going to recreate his office there. I'm looking to have a hologram of him saying, "You're better than this," as we seek to inspire another generation. We're going to also recognize Walter Sondheim. Many people may not realize that Mr. Walter Sondheim was the chair of the board of the Baltimore City Public Schools in 1954, so that when the decision came down that Justice Thurgood Marshall had got an affirmative decision in Brown versus Board, he desegregated Baltimore City Public Schools, the first school district south of the Mason-Dixon line to desegregate. And of course, I mean, I just think that it's going to tell a story, but it's going to tell a story that empowers the next generation. And that's our goal with the Justice Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center there at PS 103 Henry Highland Garnett School.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest, the Reverend Alvin Hathaway. He is spearheading the effort to renovate and establish the Justice Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center at PS 103 Henry Highland Garnett School. And it's interesting, Reverend Hathaway, that you are calling this an amenity center, not a community center, an amenity center. What's behind that that bit of naming?
Yes, just think about the nuance. When you bring resources to a community, you call them amenities. And that's what we're going to bring. We're going to bring resources to this community that will be amenities that not only will serve the community, but serve our broader community as well. I was at a office of a high public official, and he pointed to a picture on the wall. That picture on the wall was the picture of President Lyndon Baines Johnson on the day when he had appointed Thurgood Marshall as Solicitor General. In that picture was J. Edgar Hoover. It was Thurgood Marshall, his wife and two children. And also in that picture was Clarence Mitchell Jr. And he said to me, "Look at those two persons there back in 1967, standing with the President of the United States. Both of them attended PS 103, and both of them were residents of West Baltimore." We have an amazing history in our Baltimore City. It is one that should not be covered over. It's one that we should promote. And I think that the development of this PS 103, this Justice Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center, will be, I think, the beacon that begins to shine the light on this amazing community of which I was born, in which I served as pastor at Union Baptist Church.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more that the legacy of Justice Marshall is an important one for everybody to know. And I think you're right that it's not as widely discussed and thought about. I mean, they did, you know, rename the airport after Justice Marshall, but there are other things that can be done to honor his incredible legacy. You know, tomorrow, Reverend Hathaway, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Scalia from Shock Trauma about the work that he and his staff have done to develop new ways of treating traumatic injury. And you're going to have another doctor from Shock Trauma, as I understand it, Dr. Jonathan Richardson, is going to do some work at the Amenity Center. Talk about what his plans are.
Yes. When you think about, and Dr. Scalia is a friend and is an amazing personality. But when you think about what's happening now in Baltimore City with gunshots and gunshot violence, at Shock Trauma, there's a program that provides wraparound services to persons that survive a gunshot. Dr. Richardson is doing research on that area, and he's going to house his program there at the Justice Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center, where we're going to look very strategically at gunshot wounds in West Baltimore, but also throughout the city, but then provide wraparound services to those persons who are victims of gunshots. This is what we know. If a person is shot, gets shot, one, they either may go shoot somebody if they recover. Two, they may either be shot again. Or three, they're going to know a shooter. And so if we provide wraparound services around that individual, begin to provide the kind of support that they need, maybe we can begin to cut into this awesome violence that's affecting much of our city and much of our community.
And the medical community will also be involved. You're going to have something that I guess you're calling kind of a mini medical school program.
You looked at the pamphlet. Yes, one of the things that has happened at University of Maryland, Baltimore, just think about this amazing resource. It has a medical school, it has a law school, school of social work. You think about all of these schools, school of psychiatry, a school of dentistry. But one of the things they do at their University of Maryland medical school is they have what they call mini medical school. And this allows persons in the community to take medical school level courses, learn protocols, procedures, learn medical terms, learn pharmacology. All this is embedded in this free school that they call mini medical school. We're going to house that there at the Justice Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center. And people will be able to come there and educate themselves in the medical field.
And the arts are not absent from this project as well. You've got Billie Holiday being honored here as well.
Yes, we will. Johns Hopkins University has a program called the Billie Holiday Liberation Arts Program. And we're going to house that here as well. That's the cultural side of what we're going to do. They conduct now jazz concerts in Lafayette Square. They do community-based art on buildings in the community. They also do archival work, and they basically educate people around the whole area of arts. You have to realize that when you think about Pennsylvania Avenue, when you think about West Baltimore, this was the center of the African-American artistic experience. And so we're going to have the Billie Holiday Liberation Arts Program will be housed there as well.
And this project is a labor of love for you, and it's personal, isn't it? Because this is not just where you were pastor, not just the neighborhood in which we were pastor at Union, but you grew up there. I mean, you are from this community.
Yes, I was born in Providence Hospital, that was just a few blocks away. And I lived my early years as a child at 1211 Drew Hill Avenue. So I lived just a few blocks away as well. So, and then when you think about it, I just realized that almost 30 years of my ministry service has been literally in a 4-square-block area of this facility. Though I've had experiences around the world, much of my work has been right there within the community that gave me birth, that gave me nurture and gave me support.
Well, Reverend Hathaway, you have given so much to this community, and you continue to give so much even in your retirement after you've left Union. So I hope that your retirement continues to go well, and that plans for the Thurgood Marshall Amenity Center continue on apace. So thank you so much for letting us know about it. It's an exciting project. I really appreciate it.
Tom, what I say is that I'm retired, but I am not tired. So thank you, and we look forward to our continued work.
Indeed. Well, clearly you are not tired, because you got a lot going on. The Reverend Alvin C. Hathaway. And for more information about the plans for the Justice Thurgood Marshall Academy Center at Amenity Center, rather, at PS103 Henry Highland Garnet School, as well as all the organizations that we talked about on today's show, come to our website, wipr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, as I mentioned, Dr. Thomas Scalia of the Shock Trauma Center at University of Maryland. He's developed a region-wide critical care program, and he's a pioneer in the field of caring for patients around the world with traumatic injuries. We'll talk to him about his important work tomorrow on Midday. Coming up now, it's Here and Now. And later today, be sure to download the Daily Dose for all the latest news about Maryland's response to the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Happy holiday. Let's talk again tomorrow.
This is your NPR News Station. Member supported 88.1 WYPR.